very much. I've really been enjoying this conference, and I appreciate the hospitality here, and especially that people hung around after the grueling schedule. So I hope this will be entertaining and will keep you awake. Okay, so here's the issue I'm interested in. The scientist is facing the choice of some law, and there are possible laws, and these characters will be together with us through the whole talk. This is the demon of induction who's daring you to choose one of those. And I think the, you know, so many of the talks have helped to set up what I want to say, and I think Marsilio's talk yesterday is ideal, right? I want to take seriously that we can be whacked. I don't know what to make out of deducing quantum theory from pure logic. You know, this shook me up. So I'm still equilibrating over that. But I'm taking seriously that we might be fooled, and logic is not enough. Okay, so this is aimed more at my colleagues in philosophy, maybe, than in physics. What I sometimes take us to be doing is charging on a white steed at the demon of induction to defeat him so that science is preserved from his threats. And we do it with this shield of rationality, right? So that's what the capital R is about. And because of rationality, things just couldn't be so bad. I mean, look at how plausible these theories are. If you want to defeat the demon, you want to make him look weak. So you think about reliability in terms of counterfactuals, where you only have to look at a few worlds, or you put probability measures down that allow you to ignore uncountably many worlds in a set of measures zero. Somehow, you want to make things look easy. But I want to propose a dual perspective. So the dual perspective is, don't try to make the demon of induction look weak. Admit what he can do. Admit all that wonderful stuff Marsilio was talking about. Take it seriously. Build it into your model of what scientific inquiry is about. And then use that as the justification for scientific practice. Okay, so this is sort of looking at science from the other side of the looking glass, as it were. Okay, so I hope that sort of fixes the sort of approach I'm taking in your mind. How is it supposed to work? Yeah, I guess that's the next obvious question. And it goes like this. Well, if you could do better, you should. But because of the demon, you can't. So you're optimal. And if you're optimal at doing what you're trying to do, then you're justified, because the justified plan is the optimal one. But what about the Zen business, right? I mean, isn't that just what computer scientists routinely do when they justify an algorithm? What do you do? I mean, if the algorithm runs in cubic time, you do a diagonal argument or reduction to show that you couldn't have done it in squared time, and then suddenly the cubic time algorithm looks more interesting. You know, there are a lot of algorithms in computer science that look kind of boring and stupid until you find out that you can't do better. So what's the justification? It's the negative argument that gives you a lower bound on complexity of the problem. It tells you what you're really dealing with, and when you have an objective feel for how hard your problem is, then fairly prosaic means may start to look a lot more interesting. Okay? And then in philosophy, especially, the next concern will be, well, computing is about deduction, but induction is a completely different beast, requiring a completely different way of thinking. And then I'm going to say, no, actually not. You know, that's a sort of preconceived idea, but I think it's historically conditioned by the way philosophy of science developed. And there is an alternative perspective called formal learning theory, which really is a kind of smooth interfacing between computability considerations and empirical considerations, right? And that's sort of just below the surface of everything I'm going to say today. Okay, so, well, there's a sort of strategy for dealing with justification of science, but then how does it really apply? So I want to talk about Occam's razor today. So let's just, in a way, I kind of regret this. I mean, this is one group. After this conference, I don't really have to get into this. I'm just looking at retrograde motion as an example of what simplicity is about, to fix ideas. So what happens is you've got this strange correlation that Ptolemy already noticed, that retrograde motion of superior planets occurs exactly at solar opposition. And in Ptolemy's theory, it doesn't have to happen exactly at solar opposition, because it happens by epicycles, and the epicycle could be undergoing retrograde motion even when the sun is at some other angle, right? So you have to set theta at some particular value in order to get that to happen. But in the Copernican explanation, retrograde motion is just lapping, so it can only happen at solar opposition by the geometry of a heliocentric system. Okay, so the story goes. Copernicus is victorious. His theory explains the data rather than merely accommodating them. It has fewer adjustable parameters. It's more falsifiable. It's more unified. It's simpler. All these kinds of things are said. It's a sort of grab bag of stuff that we kind of subsume to Occam's razor and simplicity. And then, again, you guys can list a lot more of these than me. It seems that a lot of scientific revolutions were driven by simplicity considerations, at least in part. And so this is a significant feature to explain. But I think Occam's razor always raises a kind of puzzle, at least for me, and I think for a lot of people. It's that, if Occam's razor is supposed to be pointing us to the goal in science, if it's supposed to be showing us which theories are true, then it ought to be something like a compass or a meter or an indicator of what the truth should be. But indicators are supposed to track what they indicate, right? The trouble is that Occam's razor is sort of like a broken indicator. It always points at simple. So, I mean, it would be strange, I think, if a broken compass always got you where you're going. You'd want some kind of explanation of that. You wouldn't have to be a card-carrying skeptic to want to know how it works. And that's sort of the mystery about what Occam's razor is doing in the choice of laws and theories. So the puzzle is, how can a broken compass help you find something unless you already know where it is? Or, in a case in point, if Occam's razor is going to steer you to the truth, how can you, why should you think that it's doing that unless you already know that the truth is simple? But if you already knew that the truth is simple, why would you need Occam's razor? Actually, that's the Meno paradox, right, for Occam's razor. If you needed it, then you shouldn't be using it. And if you can use it, then you didn't need it. Okay, so now let's take a look at some standard responses. I just want to go through quickly so you can see why I think that a new story is required. Yes?
Actually, do you want questions?
Well, I think it's going to take a little while to actually get to the point, but let's try it.
Okay. So I just want to say, Marty Fitch never talked about truth. Just talk to use Occam's razor without any purpose.
Yeah. So it's part of my... I'm going to get to that, but just, so that you don't have to burn a hole in your seat about this. For me, truth is really just an idiomatic way of saying correct in some sense that transcends mere accuracy of predictions or something like that, right? So I would say at least there ought to be some sort of counterfactual import to what you're inferring. And that's going to draw a kind of a boundary between the sort of story I want and certain standard stories about Occam's razor that you get in classical statistics, say the model selection literature. All right? So that's not thick enough to be truth for me. But say getting the right polynomial degree of a polynomial law that you really take to be a law would be truth for me, even though that's just an observational law. I mean, getting the degree right may really matter to you for some purposes if you're a physicist. That wouldn't be the case if you're doing statistical learning theory for reasons I'll explain in a minute, okay? Is that helpful? So it's a thin, you know, it's a thin notion of truth, but it's not a completely thin notion of truth, right? There are some things that are going to be too thin to be what I'm talking about. Okay, so let me back up. So metaphysicians for opera, right? This is how this was discussed historically. So, you know, if you think of Occam's razor, and I think people really do, even people who should know better, fall back into this kind of thinking that there's a correlation between simplicity and truth. And so since there's a correlation, there has to be some kind of a causal explanation for that correlation, right? And we all know that there are three ways to explain a correlation causally. You can have the causal arrow go this way, that way, or that way, right? And for every possibility, there's been a metaphysician who proposed it. So the simple reality causes our simplicity bias. Well, Plato had a view like that. It's kind of mystical insight, a sixth sense. And then some naturalistic philosophers of science want to propose that natural selection gives us that sixth sense. I don't actually see how that could work. Pre-established harmony, you know, Leibniz was a co-inventor of the calculus, so he's no slouch. He saw that this was a big problem in his discourse on metaphysics and monadology. He actually proposed a common cause explanation, namely that God is an engineer. He likes elegant constructions that are just about to fall down, but don't quite. And he also is kind to us, so he gives us the right kind of bias to pick out his engineering, and everything works out. And Kant had the other arrow. So Kant in the Critique of Judgment, the Critique of Judgment, or Third Critique, starts out with a discussion of Occam's razor, and his story is a characteristically Kantian one that we are sort of simple-minded people, and since the world of experience is a projection of our way of thinking onto the matter of experience, it turns out that the world that we construct tends towards the simple. But, I mean, a lot of people have some misgivings about this. I mean, what if that kind of metaphysics is wrong? Should we just quit doing science? And furthermore, I mean, it's sort of funny that a principle that's often viewed as an injunction to cut away undetectable metaphysical realities ought to be justified by exactly such things. So I think this is not a very desirable way to proceed. More recently, in the philosophy of science literature, there's this view about virtues, that we choose theories according to their virtues. So simpler theories have lots of virtues. They're more unified. They explain better. They're more falsifiable. But those are virtues that only simple theories have. And if you don't know that a simple theory is true, then maybe the truth doesn't have those virtues. So it seems like wishful thinking to suppose that they do, right? And wishful thinking doesn't seem to be a good foundation for science. I guess I should add on to there that they compress the data. Data compression would be another one. So now let's take a look at the two main statistical explanations, prior probability bias in Bayesian methodology and risk minimization. So I think in the machine learning community and in statistics, these are the horses that smart people are betting on, and so we have to take a closer look at these. So one way to do it, and I think Harold Jeffries actually proposed this, is to just put higher prior probabilities on simpler theories, right? He had a formal definition of what a simple differential equation is, and he told you how to lay down priors that are biased in terms of simple differential equations. And of course, that will make it look like a priori simpler theories are more likely to be true, because that's what a Bayesian takes probability to be. But obviously, that's not explaining why you should do that. It's just doing it. But there's a more subtle version of this. In philosophy, it's the miracle argument. And in statistics and machine learning, it's called Bayes factors. So the intuitive way to put it is simple data are a miracle in the complex theory, but not in the simple theory, which sounds like it's based on likelihood and hence is objective, but it's not really because it's prior loaded. And the way you start to see that is, well, there's some small range of parameters in the Ptolemaic theory such that if you stayed within that range, it would be observationally indistinguishable from the Copernican theory. And so in terms of objective likelihood, that parameter setting does just as well as Copernicus theory does. But why don't you consider that very much? Well, you reason like this. Look, there wouldn't be a... So I ask you, this is a kind of way of looking at the Bayes factor argument. I come up to the Bayesian and I say, Bayesian, should I use Occam's razor? And it's sort of like the cogito, because the cogito is a funny sort of argument, right? It's every time I doubt whether I exist, I see that I exist because I'm doing the doubting. And for Bayesians, Occam's razor is like the cogito. It's every time I ask myself, should I be using Occam's razor here, I see that the answer is yes, because I wouldn't have been asking the question unless the answer was yes for me. That's a kind of a funny, I mean, it's an ingenious backhanded justification, right? So let's see how it works. Well, you wouldn't be asking me which theory you should choose if you ruled out one of the theories, right? So you must be kind of even on the two theories. But then it wouldn't be a free, you know, what do you mean by simplicity? Should I choose a simple theory? Well, you mean something like has fewer free parameters. But what makes the free parameters free? Well, if I knew how they'd be set, if that complex theory were true, then it wouldn't really be a free parameter. So I must be kind of even over the parameters. But then once I do that, I have a huge bias against the particular range of parameters that make the complex theory look like the simple one. All right? And so what we end up with is that the parameter that duplicates the performance of the simple theory within the complex theory gets a much lower prior probability than the corresponding possibility for the simple theory. And this just passes through Bayes' theorem. So that's how the argument works. So what I would say is that's just another way of having a bias against complexity in a finer partition, right? In the coarse partition between the two theories, it looks like you're even, but obviously you have a bias against complex worlds, and that passes through Bayes' theorem. So it seems to me that that's still not a completely set. I mean, it's ingenious, but it's not the kind of explanation that I'm looking for. Yeah.
The failing of the Occam factor or Bayes factor arguments, because it's basically the arbitrary uniformity of your prior over models.
Yeah, exactly. So that's what I'm saying. I mean, it's just the usual paradox of indifference, right? That's the next slide. So subjective Bayesians use this as an argument against there being some kind of a privileged prior. Yes?
Sorry, does it make your argument a little bit more attractive if you just say, well, it's not that I say that there are five parameters. I see that there are at least five parameters. And you think of like a simple theory of making that more modest.
The simple theory is saying there are at least five parameters?
Is there five degrees of freedom that produce the appearances?
Or at most, I mean, the simple theory would say there are fewer.
It says at least, and it's agnostic about all the rest. So it says there are at least five parameters that reproduce the appearances, and
I'm neutral about everything that doesn't, as it were,
show up at the level of appearance.
I'm not sure. I think I'd like to think about that and defer, because I'm not sure I quite get it. What I would like to say is, look, if you're ignorant about red versus not red, and you're ignorant within not red, then you get knowledge about red versus white. So this just isn't a uniformity of distribution, as well known, is not a good model of ignorance unless you fix a particular partition. And that's pretty much what's going on with the Bayes factor argument.
I would actually argue there's something more fundamental. Bayesian should not pick single models. It should average over models. They should all be included. you should not be like a conventional scientist who says this model is correct.
Yeah, I mean that's a further issue, right? That's a further issue. I'm just talking about whether this is a fair model of ignorance. And I guess if I had more time, I would put up the Ellsberg paradox and say that most people agree that this is not a good model of ignorance. But aside from that, I'd like to point out that the coherentist foundations of Bayesianism really don't have any, they're not even motivated by short-run truth conduciveness. They're motivated by a kind of formalistic definition of coherence. And it's another question what that has to do with getting the right answer. But then the next thing that you might be told by some Bayesians, some really don't care about this, but some will say it, is that Occam Bayesians converge to the truth. So there's some connection with the truth. And then it goes something like this. So T1 is the simplest theory, T2 is the next simplest, T3 is the next simplest, and then we update on data. And convergence could go something like this. So for some time, the data looks simple. And then we get sucked toward that corner of the simplex. Oh, is it clear that this is the space of all, this is the space of all possible probability distributions, posterior probabilities over the three theories. And I'm not looking at the data part of the model. So your posterior is going to move towards the concentrating full probability on T1. And then if you get a surprise, right, if you get some kind of second order effect, then T1 gets knocked out. And as the data start to look more and more simple towards T2, you get drawn there. And then you can get surprised again. So Bayesian convergence can look like that. Okay, I mean, there's no way that this is monotone convergence. There can be big surprises. And that's nice. I mean, I think that's the right kind of story for me. I'd like to see how things actually go. But the trouble is, this has been known for some time, mere convergence doesn't pick out any particular scientific strategy because there are a lot of alternative strategies to Occam's razor that would also converge. And the question is, why is Occam's razor the right bias to have? So my summary of the Bayesian approach is that prior-based explanations of Occam's razor are ultimately circular. They use Occam's razor rather than explaining why we should use it. And convergence-based explanations fail to single out a particular method. So they just don't succeed in explaining why Occam's razor is the right one. Okay, so let's move away from the Bayesian explanations to overfitting explanations in classical statistics. So this is quite a different setup. Bayesians at least are thinking of theories and laws as statements that you want to be true. But you could give up on that. This is getting back to your question, right? You could just give up on that and say, no, we're all instrumentalists. All we care about is predictive accuracy. And then you can get You can get a kind of explanation for Occam's razor that way. And it goes something like this. So think of an estimator, right? So if we're talking about accuracy, a good metaphor for accuracy is marksmanship, right? That's sort of like the primary use of the term. So let's look at this in terms of marksmanship. We've got a scientist who's trying to estimate some kind of quantity, and we can think of him as taking shots at a target where the true value of the parameter is the bullseye. And then if he's a good marksman, as we know, his shots will sort of cluster around the bullseye. If his glasses aren't off and there's no wind or anything, they'll actually be centered right on the bullseye and there won't be any bias, but there might be bias too. And that's what a good marksman would do at a given distance. You know, I mean, there's only so much you can do to get the spread of the points down. But here's something you might do instead. You could clamp the barrel so that the rifle can only traverse up and down. And then your shake is going to be reduced in one plane, right? So you'll produce a line of points like this. And the point is, by constraining the spread in one dimension, the average square distance from the bullseye can actually be less than it would have been with the unconstrained aim, because the lateral I locked this thing by accident. Ah, okay, I unlocked it. Because you've got this lateral spread here, those components all add to the average squared error. So if you constrain the rifle into one plane, as long as this distance is not too big, this can be better, right? So the thing I want to point out is that that's true even if the constraint absolutely prevents you from hitting the true value, right? It doesn't really matter if you can. So minimizing mean squared error of prediction is not really about finding the truth, per se. It's about minimizing square distance from it, which is quite different. Because if it mattered to you to actually hit this guy, right, if your utilities were scaled so that missing him is a disaster because he's got a gun aimed right back at you, then this might not be a very good theory of what you're trying to do. Yes?
Choosing where horizontally that lateral line goes.
Yeah, I'm not actually getting into the decision theory for this, right? I mean, if we did get into it, then we'd see that as a classic, right, as a non-Bayesian, it's a little tricky which decision theory you're even going to apply, because if you do minimax, then you wouldn't do Occam's razor. You'd do choose the most complex theory if you so. The only thing that really makes much sense is minimax regret, because the Occam strategies like AIC are, well, I shouldn't just hand wave about that. We can return to it later. So here's a point I want to emphasize.
Yeah. The criticism of Occam's razor, is that
my No. I'm just saying that this is a neat story. And, you know, modulo some other downstream stuff that we have to talk about, like what decision theory a classical statistician can apply to justify. Let me say this. What you often hear in this literature is if you use an Occam strategy, right, if you constrain the capacity of your model to accommodate the data, you will get more accurate predictions. That you will is way too quick, okay? I'm not even putting that on the table. I'm just saying, suppose even it were true, right? Suppose you really could get superior mean squared error performance out of using a simpler model. What I want to point out is that doesn't say anything about the model being true. As a matter of fact, you know, people who are expert in this, like Vapnik, in his book, he has an italics. This, you know, it's small sample. This is a small sample technique that I'm talking about. Asymptotically, it doesn't matter. And in a small sample, the most accurately predicted model will never be the true one, right? The true one is always going to have too much capacity in small samples. It's really a relationship to the sample size, right? So this whole thing is really tied to decomposing mean squared error into risk squared and into bias squared and variance. And finding where those two have a saddle point, right, when you sum them. And we call it, maybe I should just point this out. We've all heard about overfitting and underfitting, right? And sometimes you see advertising that underfitting, let's focus on overfitting. That overfitting means that you're fitting the noise rather than the signal. Well, that's not right. That's not the theory, right? Because when a physicist hears noise versus signal, you think of the signal as the law and the noise is just this errors of measurement, right? But that's not what is being factored here. Overfitting is defined as you have suboptimal risk, that is mean squared error, because you've got too much variance. And that's different from your interpreting noise as signal. Why? Because if you were really interpreting the signal, your line would go through the bullseye, right? But you're trading bias against variance, right? You're minimizing the spread, but you're picking up bias that actually prevents the thing from being true. So it's not about finding out what's true. You know, that's just overselling. And so this is about laws, right? We heard all this stuff about laws being true and having counterfactual import. So that's one of the wonderful things about this conference. A lot of this has been set up for me. So this is not about that, right? This is just giving up on that. So I want the theory of Occam's razor that doesn't give up on this, because obviously one of the major applications is in physics, and in physics you think you're doing more than this. But this is not going to be physics. I want to look at another kind of application. Why am I saying this now? In the last slide, we saw, okay, there is a kind of story based on overfitting, but it's not about finding laws. It's not about finding true theories. When does it matter? Well, I think it matters a lot, say, even if you're an instrumentalist interested in enacting policies. So here we're going to move away from physics a little bit and talk about social policy and statistical studies. So what the overfitting argument can do is give you an optimal strategy for, say, predicting incidence of lung cancer from frequency of ashtrays in the house. Right? So you take number of ashtrays as a variable, and cancer rate as a variable, and then you can do a regression. And overfitting is about finding a good regression line. But if you were predicting the effectiveness of a policy for removing ashtrays from houses, that's going to be a different matter, right? The line that I fit to the existing correlation in the ambient population when I did the retrospective study is not going to be accurate at all at predicting what the correlation between cancer and ashtrays would be after the government takes the ashtrays away. Does everybody see that? Because when government takes the ashtrays away, people just start dumping the ashes on the floor. It doesn't cut down their smoking. So when we talk about predictive accuracy, what's the moral there? Predictive accuracy, according to overfitting, is only relative to the sampling distribution that you sampled from. But if you draw counterfactual consequences from that theory, those consequences could involve an alteration of the sampling distribution, and then all bets are off about what the mean squared error would be. Is that point clear? So the overfitting explanation is not about finding laws that have counterfactual import unless you're doing experiments. Okay, so here's some news. This is something that's popular in my department. My colleagues, Clark Leemore, Peter Spurdies, and Richard Shinas have been doing this for some years. Correlation does imply causation if there are multiple variables, some of which are common effects. So, for example, just from conditional correlations over linear Gaussian models, you could uniquely discover this causal structure that absolutely sets this causal arrow in that direction, right? So you could discover something like protein C is a cause in the metabolic pathway in the body of some kind of cancer-causing protein. And there are some assumptions. This one, physicists will have problems with because of quantum correlations. But in ordinary research, it's pretty much assumed even in experimental studies. And then there's another one that's even more questionable. But if you do make those two assumptions, then conditional correlations can actually tell you something about causal structure. So I want to just focus on how the search algorithms work. This is supposed to be a faucet with one handle and two faucets attached, right? So if I twist the handle, more water comes out of both. Think of there as being a wedge in there that doesn't move, right? And this one has two handles and one faucet, so this is an ordinary one. Now notice that in this one, F1 is correlated with F2, for obvious reasons, it's the way it's put together, right? But given the setting of C, F1 gives no further information about F2, right? Because F1 is really informing about F2 only because it's informing about the handle. Now, the cool thing is that the normal faucet has the dual pattern. So the two handles are not correlated because people just walk by and set them however they want. But if you knew how much the flow was here, and you knew how this handle was set, that would tell you something about how this handle is set, right? So these patterns are dual. And so by searching for the two different patterns, you can actually orient causal directionality from retrospective studies. So that's very exciting because experiments are often expensive and immoral, right? Especially when it comes to pollution and stuff that harms us, right? We can't really put children in bubbles with pollution. Although, oddly enough, the factories do get to do that. It's kind of ironic because the factories don't generate information because they're not doing controlled experiments, so they get to do the experiments on a huge scale. But if a scientist was actually getting information out of the studies, it would be immoral, so he can't do it on a small scale. Yeah?
So this is like Pearl's interventional causality. But the difficulty I always thought with that is that you can't, from data set, when you find data set, you need to infer the underlying Bayes' net. So isn't this predicated upon the notion that that is the Bayes' net, F, depending on both H and C? Or is this somehow would work for any Bayes' net that represents the same joint distribution?
You can't always pick it out, right? But you can partition the DAGs into equivalence classes that are called indistinguishability classes, right? So what the algorithms actually infer is indistinguishability classes. Does that help? So I'm not claiming that you can get every DAG uniquely, but you
say that you can get it down to, from data alone, you can actually basically infer causation rather than correlation because you're going to restrict yourself to that equivalence class of DAGs for which causal intervention would hold.
I don't know what you mean by causal intervention.
Okay.
I mean, so what's key here is the causal faithfulness and Markov conditions. And then that's an axiomatic theory that associates joint distributions with DAGs, right? So it's a restriction on which joint distributions could be corresponding to a given causal structure. And sometimes you can't tell, right? Sometimes multiple causal structures have the same collection of distributions. For example, if there are only two variables, then this, and common cause are all indistinguishable, right? So the indistinguishability class would include all three.
Okay, so this is not Pearl's notion of a
causality. Well, actually, I mean, this result is really based on work by Verman and Pearl, so I'm not sure what we're disagreeing about. Okay, yeah. The causal Markov condition is that each variable X is independent of its non-effects given its immediate causes. So this is just the usual screening condition.
What are non-effects?
Non-effects are variables that aren't downstream causally of the given variable.
I see. This is like what people sometimes call Reichenbach's.
It's a generalization of this, right? Exactly. Yeah. It's a generalization of Reichenbach's screening condition. And this is like the converse. So another way to think of these is more intuitively is that the causal Markov condition insists on a causal explanation of every correlation, and the faithfulness condition says you never get exactly canceling causal paths that erase correlations if there is causation. So these are kind of like, one is the converse of the other, more or less.
Can I ask one other
question? Yeah, sure.
So I see how on the right, possibly you could have a...
Oh, this one? Okay.
But typically, if you observe conditional independence of F1 and F2 given C, you would have three possible causal structures.
Exactly. I agree. Okay. Yeah. That's right. So that's what I'm saying. I'm not. This goes back to the last question. I'm not saying that you can discriminate everything. It's just that you can discriminate the right-hand guy from the collection of three on the left, right?
Okay.
And then that may propagate, right? So the interesting thing about this method is that you can search for the non-oriented structure by looking at some conditional correlations to find out what's directly connected to what. And then after you do that, you can look for this characteristic pattern. And since that's characteristic, you can write those two arrows down, right? Then that's going to entail lots of others. So you're exactly right. That's why I said, I mean, Hume was right that you can't set the arrow just from constant conjunction of two. But the surprise is that if you have three or more, maybe you can if you're lucky. Obviously, if everything is causally connected, then you don't get anything. Right? So if it's a click, that's not orientable at all, because all possible orientations of a click turn out to be equivalent. But if you've got something that's sparse and it has some of these normal faucets in it, then you're in good shape. Okay, so two standard applications, linear causal case. Each variable x is a linear function of its parents, and a normally distributed hidden variable called an error term. And then the discrete multinomial case is each variable x takes on a finite range of variables, and it's a Bayes net. Okay, so now you're thinking, there's got to be some kind of a catch if you can infer causes from correlations, right? I mean, because experiments still seem to be better. And what I want to say is, yes, there is a catch. The catch is this. Suppose that you apply one of these strategies, and the strategies are guaranteed to converge in the Bayesian sense to the true model, right? So you can converge to the truth in the limit this way. But this is something that can happen. So the data can be just a dead ringer for this structure. And then when the sample size goes up, the data can be a dead ringer for this structure. And when the sample size goes up again, the data can be a dead ringer for this structure. Right? If there are small correlations that you miss at a smaller sample size, those can come back to bite you later by forcing the causal arrow of interest to flip. And that wouldn't happen if you had experiments under the usual experimental assumptions. So we just submitted a paper to UAI, Connor Mayo Wilson and I, with something we call the causal flipping theorem. So basically what this says is what I just said before. No matter how good the data look for a given causal structure, as long as your method is capable of converging to the true causal structure at all, it might have been that the truth was an alternative structure such that as the sample size goes up with arbitrarily high chance, the arrow flips any number of times. Yes?
So usually in a situation like this, a good experimentalist would say that data cannot distinguish between the different possibilities.
That's right. So I don't want to. I actually think that when it comes to theories, this is more or less endemic. And I don't want to draw that same skeptical conclusion. So we agree that that's a common response.
OK, so but even before there is more data, you don't just say that, OK, the data points to this, and then change your mind. You just say the data is not sufficient.
Yeah, you could. I mean, you could just refuse to draw these. But then, of course, you'd be throwing out this whole methodology, right? Then you say, OK, you either have to put a child in the beach ball with the pollutants, or let the factory keep polluting, right? That's the cost of skepticism, right? Skepticism is not really standing on the sidelines when it comes to policy. Yes?
So you said that the causal arrows might reverse when you increase your sample size.
Right.
But your diagrams involved introducing variables that ended up being causally relevant that were previously unobserved. So I'm not clear. I mean, if your conclusion had been, well, you know, your causal conclusions depended on the assumption that there were no other causally relevant variables besides the ones whose correlations you were looking at, I sort of would have been with you. But then you started talking about sample size, and I'm confused. Is it or the other, or both, that you're claiming?
What I'm claiming is, if you've got a procedure that can converge to the true causal structure, that's the only antecedent, right? And we're playing this causal inference game. That's all that's on the table. Then whatever conclusion you've drawn with whatever high chance on a given sample, you can be forced to flip the causal conclusion any number of times in some other causal structure that's statistically indistinguishable from indistinguishable from the one you thought you had. That's the point.
I go through the flipping and the number of variables don't change.
Sorry about this. what happened here. Okay.
So the number of variables don't change in your...
No. I mean, those are variables that just didn't seem to be relevant to anything because you didn't detect any correlations at all.
I see.
I mean, that could happen, right? Correlations are small, and you just don't notice them with statistical techniques until the tests power up, right?
Okay.
And then what I'm trying to get you to... what I'm trying to argue is that that's always the case when, you know, whenever you make a universal conclusion, you're saying I haven't seen certain kind of effects. They might have been small, right? This goes back to Marsilio's. So I think this is really endemic. You know, these small things can always come and bite you later.
But so yes. You're not doing Bayesian inference of DAG, which would actually give you distribution over all DAGs, including...
That doesn't matter. I mean, if you were a Bayesian and you had a posterior, this theorem is still going to apply. And given only that you're a consistent Bayesian in the sense that... Your posterior gets arbitrarily high with arbitrarily high chance as the sample size goes up, it's going to be the same thing because I can just drag your posterior here and then drag your posterior there and drag your posterior here and drag your posterior there. Remember, Bayesians don't converge monotone, right? They jump all over the place. Remember the Bayesian picture. I can make that happen because these DAGs are successively more complex theories, right? And the Bayesian can be led to successively more complex theories. So the Bayesianism, hedging your bets is really one of the big red herrings in epistemology. It doesn't amount to, you know, it amounts to epsilon, but the surprises are still going to get you. And here's a picture, actually. So Connor did simulation trials of one of my colleagues' best algorithms, called the conservative PC algorithm that plays this kind of game in the case that we were looking at, right? So in exactly the pictures that I gave you, we fed it increasing sample size for the last graph in the sequence, the complex one. And what you're looking at here is a histogram of 1,000 trials at each of these sample sizes of what the orientation of the key cancer-causing edge was, right? And here's what you have. It starts out thinking that the arrow goes this way with very high chance, and then the chance dips to nothing, and the other arrow orientation pops up, and then because of consistency, we ran out of cycles with our laptop, right? But because of the consistency of the procedure, this is going to end up converging to 0 and 1 again, right? So what you're seeing there is two retractions of opinion, right? So it happens. It happens with real procedures and procedures that people have used to publish papers in the social sciences. So here's my Zen response to this, okay? The response A is to give up. I think that's the majority common response. But the alternative response, here's something Connor found in the New York Times Magazine back in 2007. Many explanations have been offered to make sense of the here today, gone tomorrow nature of medical wisdom. What we're advised with confidence one year is reverse the next, but the simplest one is that it's the natural rhythm of science. So I want us to start thinking that maybe Marsilio is right. This is just the way scientific theorizing is because of the kind of problem it is. And we should stop papering over that fact and absorb it into our justification of the scientific method.
I know. Let me ask a question.
Okay, sure.
How are you progressing in your talk? Because it's now been near 50 minutes.
Okay, all right. Not very well.
Maybe once you come in.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. I'll have to speed up. So here's the. But I think, you know, I have to sort of deal with those. Hobgoblins first, and now I think we can go faster. So here's the idea. Let's think harder about what pursuit of the truth means. What is effective pursuit of the truth? I think one of the problems with epistemology is that a lot of sophisticated mathematics has been thrown down some shallow, dry holes when it comes to what would success be. One kind of common view is it should be short-run tracking of the truth. But that's too strong to be feasible when you've got to do these kind of multiple retraction problems, like theory choice. That's just too ambitious. And so you get the skeptical answer, right? Convergence in the limit is too weak because it doesn't determine any particular method. So what I'm going to propose is maybe efficient convergence of the truth is the place to find what scientific method is about. So if you've got big surprises coming, at least minimize them. And here's some ancient motivation. This is from the Upanishads, 600 BC, living in the midst of ignorance and considering themselves intelligent and enlightened, the senseless people go round and round following crooked courses, just like the blind led by the blind. So the idea is we're going to follow crooked courses anyway, but no point making it more crooked than necessary. So here's a kind of idea of how it works. This is just an allegory, but it gives you the essential idea. So the puzzle is, how do we find something with a broken compass? Or to put it more generally, how can advice by somebody who doesn't know where you're going, how could it possibly be useful advice to find where you're going? It sounds like a paradox, right? I mean, how could... But I'm going to tell you it happens every day. So here are two city slickers lost in central Pennsylvania on the way back from this conference, and they ask a local where, right? So this is the situation. Just freeze it, right? And what does this guy answer? He doesn't... They didn't say where they wanted to go yet, but this is a little town. They're lost in a little town. They want to get home. Is there anything useful he can say?
What about town?
He can be more specific than that. Actually, this happened, you know, this is autobiographical. And I realized it was the logic. You know, I had all this mathematics, and then I realized this is what's going on.
Wait, is
there actually the city? Well, how would, yeah, but he doesn't know which city, right? The freeway. Yeah, he'll tell you to get on the freeway, right? And that's good advice, because it doesn't matter where a city slicker is going, the freeway is the best course. And so he just gave advice without knowing where you're going that was useful advice. So maybe Occam's razor is like getting on the freeway to the truth. Okay, so let's take a look at how that works. The goal could be any one of these big cities, and there you are in a little town off the freeway system. If you take his advice, you get home like that. And wherever you were going, that would be the best way to go. But if you ignored his advice, all you would end up doing is either going home by a really lousy route through the mountains or doing a U-turn and following his advice, which means that you've got one extra course reversal. So he gave you helpful advice to find something where you didn't know where, you know, you didn't... He didn't know where you were headed, but he gave you useful advice to find it a priori. So let's think about a simplified model of curve fitting. Your data are going to be open intervals around y at rational values of x, and you can specify what those values are. And so your job is to say what the true degree is. So this is how, this is different from overfitting, right? Because in overfitting, you don't care what the true degree is. You just choose it to get accurate predictions. But here, we really care what the degree is, suppose. So you see a first order effect when no constant line fits through. You get a second order effect when no line fits through, and so forth. And then you can do something similar with Occam's razor, right? Because if you never get ahead of the demon, that is to say, if you never get ahead of the effects that have been presented so far, at worst, you follow him step by step, which is the best anybody could do. But if you get impatient and go ahead of the demon, then, well, you don't know that the demon's going to come, right? He may just hang back. What is this? This is what happens when you've accidentally violated Occam's razor and you start getting null effects. So the pressure builds, right, because the scientist wants to at least converge to the right answer. So on pain of losing, he has to come back. But then as soon as he does, the demon has all the remaining moves, right? So he ended up with an extra U-turn. And the proposal is that's an a priori feature that Occam's razor has that other alternative methods wouldn't have. That's a basic idea. Yeah?
The issue with a lot of these models is that if you just redefine what you mean by simple, you'll get different answers.
Yeah, but we have an account of that. Okay? It's not. So it turns out that simplicity is the path that the demon can drag you down. And that's asymmetrical given a question. So we can get to that. So the Occam path looks like this. I'm sorry. And the non-Occam path looks like that. That's the advantage. So let's look at how to turn this into a result. I'll try to go really quick here. A great thing about this conference is several of us have been talking about questions as being fundamental to inquiry. I start out with exactly the same kind of thing. You've got a partition of input streams. That's your question. You're supposed to find the true answer to the question. And this is very similar to what we just saw before. We've got a scientific method. But here I've got the structure where you only see a finite initial segment, which wasn't in the last model. And you have to answer in response to the finite initial segment. That I already said. Your aim is to converge to the true model, so you don't, unlike the last model of inquiry we saw, you don't have to get it right by some fixed time. You just have to eventually get it right. This corresponds to Bayesian consistency. A retraction is choosing T and then not choosing T at the next stage. That is to say, you lose content from one stage to the next. Your aim is to eliminate needless retractions. We already discussed that. And we're going to have another aim, which is to minimize delays to retractions that you perform. For one reason, you don't want lemmas and corollaries of these theories to build up unnecessarily before you flush them, because all that stuff has to be reexamined. I'll pass that up in case it comes up. Now we're going to compare retraction times basically by saying one performance is at least as bad as another performance if you can map each of the at least as bad ones. Let's put it this way. So this is at least as bad as that if each of these retractions maps to some retraction that's at least as late. Okay, so it's Pareto with respect to number of retractions and time of occurrence. We can have abstract worst-case upper bounds on sets of these performances based on the same kind of order. If there's no finite bound, put the infinity sign there. And now I have to tell you what simplicity is. Here's the answer to David's question. An empirical effect is some observable event that when you notice it, you don't forget it. And it may take arbitrarily long to notice, right? It may come as late as you please. So think about the conditional correlations that were small but took a long time to notice in the causal graph case. Those are effects. Each theory is going to correspond to the set of effects it implies. And now you've got an ordering of theories by the effects that they imply. That's going to be the simplicity ranking for the theories. The more complex ones imply more effects. I'm going to assume, to get stronger results, that there are no branching paths of simplicity where one path is shorter than another. I feel like that was a mistake now. This is kind of like a cosmological constant in my theory. I was too greedy. So I'm going to eliminate this in future work. Okay.
Make it very, very small.
And then Occam's razor is going to be, don't select a theory unless it's uniquely simplest in light of experience. And there's another complementary principle which is don't retract your answer while it's uniquely simplest. This is a sort of don't give up just because you read a philosophy book. There has to be a concrete sign from nature that the simplest theory is no longer best. All right. And then I'm not sure how much of the technicality we need to go through here. Let RMEN be the least time retraction bound covering the total time retractions of M along input streams of complexity N that extend E. This is quite similar to David's model, except that we're looking at fans of possibilities consistent with the current data. So this is like an ex post analysis. Efficiency means for every empirical complexity degree, your worst case bound is no worse than anybody else's, right? So for every other alternative method that converges to the truth, his worst case bound is at least as bad as yours in each complexity class. It's a very strong property so far as worst case properties go. So no matter how complex the theory is, my bound on worst case retraction bound retraction times is no worse than yours if you converge to the truth. That's for an arbitrary method. And being beaten means there's some other method alternative to you that does better in every complexity class compatible with the data. And the basic idea is that nature can force an arbitrary convergent M to produce the successive answers down an effect path arbitrarily late, so stalwart Occam solutions are efficient. That's a sketch of the argument for efficiency. And the unique efficiency is that a violator of Occam's razor or stalwartness can be forced into an extra retraction or a late retraction at the time of the violation, so they're beaten. Okay, so what we have is that all methods that converge to the truth are partitioned cleanly into the Occam methods that are efficient, in a sense defined, and the non-Occam methods that are beaten. So there are no hard cases where you're neither efficient nor beaten. And that's the theorem. So let M converge to the truth. That's what solution means. The following are equivalent. M is henceforth Occam and stalwart. M is henceforth efficient. And M is henceforth never beaten. So those are equivalent. That's the main upshot. Here I want to show you a concrete application of this kind of thinking. This, again, is causal inference. One of the published algorithms of my colleagues has a spike here. This is an extra retraction and chance due to an Occam violation. So this shows actually that in terms of concrete practice, this theory is not toothless. If you recall the last graph I showed you, it didn't have any spike like this. So their later algorithm is actually more efficient in terms of retraction minimization than the earlier one was. And this actually got their programmer interested in the retraction theory, because it's not so easy to characterize why the new algorithm is better, given that it doesn't avoid retractions at all. So some generalizations. I spoon-fed the concept of simplicity by assuming that there are these things effects. It would be much more interesting to construct the effects for a given question right off of the question. So we can do that, and I can talk about it if you like. Bayesian retractions were another question that came up. We've just done that. Another question that comes up is that this is based on worst-case bounds. So we know that in rock, paper, scissors, you can get better minimax bounds by mixed strategies. So there's a question whether the theorem is still valid with respect to mixed strategies. We just completed the proof that it is. Sorry. So all of this stuff is done in yellow. Things that we're planning to do is to drop the no short pass assumption, weight retractions by the content retracted, and apply the whole thing to statistical inference, which isn't done yet. And so that's it. Thanks for being patient through a long-winded presentation.
Analogy between coming up with best theory and natural selection. You might ask, for example, if we were in a lab and we could evolve viruses or whatever forward or organisms, and we had a goal, we'd say, oh, let's, if we want to evolve vision, what is the best way, how to set up the conditions so that we can most quickly evolve vision? You could try to find these sorts of ideas and say, well, you know, there'll be some, you know, bad strategies, evolutionary strategies, and we kind of want to make the jitter as small as possible. But that would sort of be missing the idea that there could be a population of different strategies at any given time, and it's conceivable that, you know, diversity is the key to rapid convergence to what you're looking for. So I wonder whether here as well, it might also be conceivable that we should entertain a number of different possibilities, find out their corollaries and so forth, and work hard on them, you know, across the scientific community, have this diversity of approaches, rather than all focusing, you know, agreeing on one approach which tries to minimize the number of retractions.
I think we have to be careful about the metaphors there, because it might not be matching up. I mean, think about what I'm worried about. I'm worried about the kind of things that Marsilia was talking about, where there are surprises, these small surprises that aren't detectable yet that might come and bite you. And I'm not sure how discussions among these theories is really going to help, other than just not converging to the true one, right? So the cost of that might be, you know, we have to go through the cases. Remember, this argument is if you converge to the truth at all, then you're forcible through these retractions, and so Occam's razor is most efficient. If you have a method that doesn't really converge to the truth because it always keeps multiple possibilities alive, then, yeah, you can avoid retractions altogether just by keeping all the possibilities on the table. Right? So I'm not exactly sure what the, you know, how to fit your analogy into the, there are different ways to flesh out your analogy, and I think the answer is going to be different depending on how you do it, right? You have to tell me what you're doing with the set. If the set gets smaller, you know, eventually and converges to one, then I'd say I can still force it through all the retractions if you can define retractions for sets properly. And I've been doing that because one application I'm interested in is sets of probability measures, right? I mean, I complained about Bayesianism as being a good model of ignorance, but a natural response to that is to have a set of posterior distributions evolving, right? This is something that some Bayesians urge. And then convergence would be the set of distributions gets smaller and smaller around the right corner of the simplex, right? But that I can force retractions out of. You know, I can force it to collapse around this corner of the simplex, and then boom, it's going to jump over and cover the whole line on the other side and then converge like that, and then boom, it's going to go over here. So that, I say, is just retracting. So if you have convergence in your evolutionary picture, then this still applies. If you don't, then it doesn't, but you're not converging to the truth. Those would be the two cases.
The lock here I'm very curious about. I've only got some of the older papers, so dumb stuff on me. But one thing, especially when you're talking about this, the thing that immediately hits me is dynamic programming. And there are results like for just two-armed bandits where you're just doing the Bayes optimal thing, so dynamic programming, coming back up, that with non-zero probability, you will lock in to choosing the suboptimal strategy, and you will be with zero infinitesimal probability where you get any data that would actually make you go out. So non-zero, I'm going to do the worst thing for forever if I'm actually all the way along doing Bayesian updating of what will be my best expected discounted future sum of rewards. This might be just analogies too far, but how is there any way that I could see how I'm given pause because that seems inconsistent with your picture.
Well, two-armed bandit, I mean, you know, the point here is that the question, you know, the retractions are being forced, really what's going on is those are iterated problems of induction, right? So it's like Hume's problem stacked up. So if your question doesn't actually involve that kind of problem of induction, then this stuff will only apply trivially.
We're looking sort of flip around. Even though this is giving you minimized probability of retraction, might it still be giving you non-zero probability that you'll lock on to the wrong answer, probability, non-zero probability, no matter how your data comes in?
Well, I mean, the assumption of this theorem is that you converge to the true answer necessarily, right? So there's no room for not converging. I mean, that's what makes the retractions happen.
Okay, so the multi-arm bandits must then be a fundamentally different kind of approach.
Yeah, I mean, you have to be careful to apply this, you know. It's more like where this makes sense is where your payoff is discontinuous with parameters, right? And I don't see that happening with the bandit problems because you've got continuity there. So when your loss is continuous with parameter, I consider that to be more or less a statistically deductive problem. The problem of induction is going to happen where you really have a sharp loss if you get things at the edge of a partition cell wrong. And that's what happens in the causal graph case, because there are going to be models, you know, the true graph, the true joint distribution could be a limit point of distributions that have the opposite causal arrow orientation. And if my loss is based on how poorly I predict the effects of a policy, like removing ashtrays, then I'm going to have a discontinuous loss with respect to the underlying parameter governing the joint distributions, right? So that's where this stuff makes sense. And so I think it's not the case in the two-arm bandit. It's too continuous.
I was wondering if you could say a little more to motivate the idea that what we really want to do is minimize latent retractions, and here's the kind of thing that's
okay.
Consider a case like this. You've got a bunch of NIH mm-hmm. scientists who are trying to figure out whether smoking causes cancer,
mm-hmm.
and there's two methods they might use, and they both converge to the truth necessarily, and suppose it just so happens that if they use method one, they'll change their minds every year for 100 years
mm-hmm.
until they arrive at the truth. And if they use method two, they'll, after the first year, say, no, they don't cause cancer. And they'll
mm-hmm.
keep saying that without any reversals for 95 years. Then in the 95th, you reverse to the truth and
mm-hmm.
stay there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the second one is the one that minimizes late reversals. But the first one has an obvious advantage that at least half the time they're giving people good advice, whereas you minimize for 95 years. So...
Well, I think one way out of that is the preferences in the result are not going to actually be affected by that case, because what's really going on is that you can force these things arbitrarily late, right? Each retraction can be forced to occur arbitrarily late, so the premise of your example It doesn't apply in this case, right? There's not going to be a bound by which they're over. And moreover, any method can be forced to produce any number of errors, right, in these kind of problems.
Okay, but
If there were such a bound, then this theory would say, retract at all.
Suppose that we're the scientists and we don't know the things I just said.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, that is how it's going to go. But we know that... Suppose we know that the second method is the one that is going to have the fewest late retractions, but for all I know, it might be the one that ends up making us give people terrible advice for a longer time. So why is it any comfort to me that this is the method that will, in which I can be forced to make the smallest number of late retractions?
Is it perhaps that you display a loss function in there where Kevin doesn't?
Well, I mean, we can view this as, you can think of this as a Pareto preference relation governing everything, where the first, you can do it with lexicography. So the first tier is you've got to converge, and then the second tier is going to be something like Pareto over retraction time.
I just kind of seen utilities, which is implicit in John's question.
Oh, I didn't catch that there was a discount on utilities.
Well, not only a discount, but he's got a sum of things over time. And you're saying that you're...
Yeah, the idea is that What makes it not so clear that the late reversal minimizing method is better is that over the long haul, the policy effects of following that method.
The average loss might.
Yeah, right. That's right.
Yeah. Again, I think it's really not the kind of case this is intended to. to handle, because, you know, these are worst case losses. This is classical stuff. And in the worst case, again, every method can be forced to produce any number of errors arbitrarily long. So this theory isn't getting any traction at all on what would happen in such a hard problem over the first 100 stages. What I say is one reason to care about it is that these are long, one reason I care about retractions, obviously, is that it's something epistemic that remains bounded in the worst case, at least in complexity classes, so it gives you non-trivial comparisons. So to me, the decision theory here is supposed to be teasing out something that's objectively better. It's not supposed to be, you know, that's the way I look at the decision theory, right? It's to, I guess I should say this. When it comes to Occam's razor, it's not that the dog isn't the soprano, it's that it sings Mozart at all, right? I mean, it's not easy to come up with anything. It's not easy to come up with anything that gives you a non-circular story for Occam's razor. And the retractions are something, you know, errors are just not bounded, right? So even within a complexity class, they're unbounded, so it just gives you all methods are the same. The retractions in their times are bounded within a complexity class, and they also are just the right kind of thing to get these dominance properties over complexity classes. So, I mean, what I want to do is to treat inductive inference the way computer scientists treat algorithms, to divide cases into cells by complexity and then look at worst-case bounds of performance over those. And you could say, like, who really cares about Turing time so much, right? It's the same kind of question, you know. I think that NP completeness theory is a great thing, but it's vulnerable to exactly the same kind of objection you're raising. So I wouldn't say that this is any better than that. I'd say it's about the same kind of thing. Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
The ring feature. Sorry.
I'm wondering how broadly applicable this kind of account is. I mean, it seems to fit very naturally with trying to find causes based on correlations.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the reason for that is because you're flipping arrows, right? So,
yes.
So that fits nicely with the
yes.
analogy with the ropes,
mm-hmm.
right? That there's only so many paths you can take
that's right.
to get to the truth. Seems like maybe physics isn't so much like that. The historical process of discovery in more complicated cases like that doesn't fit so nicely maybe onto that road analogy. Why would there only be so many ways to get to the truth? Why should we think of discovery and formulating new theories as being something like the freeway system, right? I mean, why are you going to be forced back on the same path you were on? I mean, that's natural in a causal case where it's a matter of having the two choices.
Oh, I see. I think it happens all the time. So what, you know, modulo details that, you know, this is a formal model, so always there's stuff that doesn't quite fit, and it's the theorist says, okay, that's junk, like, you know, Feynman says that, right? So don't pay attention to Hooke's law, but particle interactions are real physics, you know? So I would say, yeah, there's going to be all this other stuff. Let me give you an example. So really, the Copernicus Ptolemy case doesn't even work, right? Because for me, stellar parallax is an effect, and Copernicus implies that effect, but Ptolemy doesn't, right? And the guy who really noticed that was Tycho. So Tycho's theory is the simplest of the three because it doesn't have stellar parallax either. So it got all the regularities that Copernicus got, but it didn't have stellar parallax, and he crowed him, you know, he said, I'm the winner because I've got the simplest theory, and nobody went for it. So, I mean, he actually recognized the game I'm talking about. He said, I won the game. Nobody went with him anyway for some other kind of reasons, right? Because, for example, his setup totally blew away Aristotelian physics anyway. So it didn't pick up any prior probability from that, right? And it needed some kind of weird gears or struts. Nobody could figure out how it would work. they could kind of imagine how Ptolemy's thing would work as marbles in coconut shells or something, right? So there's all that stuff. There's all that stuff outside of this theory, right? What this theory is supposed to do is to focus on why is it that Tycho said, "I win," you know? What was that about? Why is it that people sided with Copernicus before there were telescopic observations? If you believe that kind of folklore, this is a story that tells you something about it. And I would say, you know, Airy wrote the review paper about the wave theory of optics. He said that what was really, really, really persuasive about the wave theory is its unification of internal, external diffraction bands, and double slit and thin plates, right? It could do all of that stuff. You know, that kind of unification is impressive. That would count as a simpler theory here. So that was a case where the particle theory was very complex. We said that first by mistake because Newton thought that you wouldn't get geometrical shadows with the wave theory, and that wasn't really explained until Fresnel did it. Then when the Fresnel explanation was on the table, people said, oh, we made a logical mistake. This thing really looks simple, right? So they switched back. I would say that's an that's an application of this, is an intended application of this. Those are the kind of cases I have in mind. Now, you could say it's a Bayesian. No, it's really just Bayes factors, but I'd like it to be more robust stuff than that. So this is a kind of computational complexity account of what happens in those cases. And, you know, I mean, more speculatively, we saw the pure logical deduction of quantum mechanics here depends on logical symmetries, right? If you knock those out, right, I think that you can knock those out with observations. Isn't it possible that those symmetries could be contradicted?
I don't see that they can.
Oh, I see. Okay.
I don't think so.
Well, then that's bad. See, that's why I didn't like your talk.
I've been stopping people from asking you next questions.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
Allowed to ask anyone else questions. So we really should stop that.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
So let's thank all of you.